Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Today, we have a very wonderful speaker with us whose research and advocacy has dramatic impacts on a person's health and wellness. His name is Dr. Matt Walker. Matt focuses his scientific research on something that we all need but often seems to escape us, a good night's sleep. Working across the fields of neuroscience and psychology in both teaching and research capacities, Matt says that the loss of sleep has become a major global public health epidemic, and the links between sleep deprivation and a number of different issues from psychiatric disorders, obesity, even cancer, have grown quite rapidly over the years.
He's professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory. Research in the laboratory focuses on the cognitive aspects of sleep of the sleeping brain by using a multimodal imaging approach, which includes MRI, neurophysiological, and psychophysical techniques. Looking forward to learning a little more about that. Calling the global sleep loss epidemic the greatest public health challenge we now face in the 21st century, Matt examines the impact on the human brain, function in clinical and in healthy populations. Through his work at UC Berkeley, he's been at the forefront of sleep research. He's linked sleep deprivation to all kinds of disorders, psychiatric, obesity, risky behavior, PTSD, learning, and memory loss in old age. And he's found a link between poor sleep and the buildup of a protein linked to Alzheimer's, which is a major breakthrough in our understanding of the disease that shows just how critical a good sleep is to all of us. Matt earned his PhD in neurophysiology from the Medical Research Council in London and subsequently became professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. He's the recipient of funding awards from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. He's been featured on CBS 60 Minutes and on the National Geographic documentary Sleepless in America, among other programs. Matt's the recipient of numerous funding awards from the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. He's a Kavli Fellow of the National Academy of Sciences. To date, he's published over 80 research studies describing the critical importance of sleep for learning, memory, creativity, emotional regulation, and cardiovascular health. And he has just returned yesterday from the UK after having given talks in Europe. So Matt, delighted, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and it's a delight to be sharing this time and this space with the Awakening audience. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. So why don't we start at the beginning? Can you tell us a little bit? We all, sleep is one of the most familiar things to all of us, and yet what do we know about it? And can you start off with talking a little bit about what is sleep actually, and, you know, the different issues and ways we deal with sleeping?
Yeah, and sleep used to actually be this remarkable enigma in science. Until very recently, no one had any consensus answer as to why we slept, which is remarkable when you think that we've known the functions of the three other main biological drives, which is to eat, to drink, and to reproduce, for many decades, if not hundreds of years. But this fourth biological drive, which is common across every living species, the drive to sleep, has eluded scientific judgment. And the best that we used to have in terms of an explanation was that the reason that we sleep is to cure sleepiness, which, when you think about it, is a profoundly unhelpful answer. It's sort of like saying, you know, the reason that we need to eat is to cure hunger. And that tells you nothing about the nutritional benefits that food actually provides. But now, over the past 10 years, through an explosion of wonderful science, we understand that there is no single process within your brain and there is no single physiological system within the body that is not powerfully enhanced when you get sleep or demonstrably impaired when you don't get enough. So we've now been forced to upend the question in a way. We've been forced to say, rather than asking what is the function of sleep, we've been sort of challenged to say, is there actually anything that doesn't benefit from sleep? And the answer seems to be no. Everything is tied to sleep in one way or the other. So I hope that we can explore all of those different functions and perhaps shatter some myths that surround sleep and sufficient sleep. But I also think, just in responding to your question, what is sleep? That's such a critical question. I think many of us think that we simply lose consciousness and our brain is dormant and our body gets a little bit of rest and gets some recharging and then we wake up. And so what's the harm if we shortchange our sleep by going to bed late or perhaps waking ourselves up too early with an alarm clock? Sleep is not a dormant state. It's an incredibly active state in the brain and the body. There are some parts of your brain that are up to 30% more active in some stages of sleep relative to when you're awake. So there are, in fact, two principal stages of sleep that we cycle through that many people perhaps have learned about. One of them is non-rapid eye movement sleep, or non-REM sleep for short. The other is rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep, which is commonly associated with dreaming. That's REM sleep. And it turns out that you ebb and flow through a cycle of non-REM to REM sleep every 90 minutes. And you will replay that 90-minute cycle every 90 minutes throughout the night. It's this sort of incredible cerebral war, as it were, that is won and lost between these two stages of sleep. But what's interesting is that although that cycle length of 90 minutes, non-REM to REM, non-REM to REM, is stable across the night, the ratio balance of non-REM to REM within each of those 90-minute cycles changes as you move across the night, such that in the first half of the night, the majority of those 90-minute cycles are comprised much more of that deep non-REM sleep, that sort of classic restorative sleep that we think about it, with very little REM sleep, very little dreaming happens in the first half of the night. As you push through to the second half of the night, now that seesaw balance actually changes, and instead those 90-minute cycles are comprised much more of rapid eye movement sleep and a lot less deep non-REM sleep. And all of these stages of sleep are important. And the reason I sort of try to emphasize this is not just sort of dry academic information. It has a big impact on your sleep depending on how you sleep. And what I mean by that is if you go to bed a little bit too late, perhaps an hour or an hour and a half later than you normally would, and you say, well, or 2 hours, let's say, how much sleep have I lost relative to a normal 8 hours? And you'd say, well, I've lost 25% of my sleep because I've gone to bed 2 hours too late. And I'm going to wake up at the same time, so I only got 6 hours rather than eight. But that's not true, actually. You didn't just lose 25% of your sleep. You've probably lost almost 60 to 70% of your deep sleep.
Wow.
And it works the same way on the back end, too. Let's say that you're a teenager and you know, you've gone to bed during the week at the normal time, but now you have to wake up for your early school bus that next morning because you've got athletic training. And you have to wake up an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours earlier than you would like to otherwise. How much sleep have you lost? Maybe, you know, 20, 30%. Well, true, you've lost that total amount of sleep, but you've actually lost perhaps almost 80 to 90% of your REM sleep. So we have to be so careful. We can't burn the candle at either one of those ends based on how sleep plays out across the night in terms of this canonical structure. So hopefully that gives people a bit of a sense of the framing and the types of sleep and the unfolding architecture. It's this beautiful ballet of physiology when you watch it. Oh, I'm still looking to see it in my lab each night.
Yeah, the complexity of this is very interesting. I know that my own habits tend to be, well, I've lost an hour or two of sleep tonight, so I'll sleep an hour or two extra tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of what you're saying is that will not catch me up.
No, this is one of the myths that is so critical for people to recognize and embrace. We found no evidence that you get back all of the sleep that you lose. And what I mean is that sleep is not like the bank. You cannot accumulate a debt and then hope to pay it off at a later point in time.
Mm.
And now, this isn't to suggest that if I deprive you of sleep tonight and then ask how much sleep you go to get on the next night when I give you the chance to recover, you're going to sleep longer on that recovery night. However, what you don't do, let's say that you're normally sleeping 8 hours and then I deprive you of one night, and then the next night we would expect, if sleep did work like the bank, that you would not only get your normal 8 hours, but then you would go back and you'd recoup that entire debt, that entire extra 8 hours that I took away from you, so you would sleep 16. And you don't. Not even close. You may sleep perhaps 10 hours, maybe 11 hours. And even if I keep going, even if I keep letting you get as much sleep as you want after deprivation, you never get back all that you lost. So there is no safety net in place. And that's not the case for other aspects of your body. And let's take calories, for example. Your body does have a credit system for calories, and they're called fat cells. And we have developed the system of fast and feed, famine and plenty. And our bodies have learned that there are times when there will be lots of food around, so you can store it and hold on to those calories because there may be famine ahead.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that for sleep. And then you may ask, well, why? And the answer is this. Human beings are the only species that deliberately deprive themselves of sleep.
Uh-huh.
No other species that we see will do this without biological gain. And what that means is that evolution has never faced the challenge of insufficient sleep since the dawn of time. As a consequence, Mother Nature has never had to solve this problem of a lack of sleep, so it doesn't have any safety nets to give us.
Interesting. I want to ask you another general question about sleep. I noticed in myself and others that when I was younger and missed sleep on a given night, I could seemingly bounce back and have my something close to my normal energy the following day and then the day after that. But as I've gotten older, it doesn't work that way. Losing sleep one day seems to carry forward many days forward. And I'm wondering, what's the difference in sleep in a younger person versus sleep in an older person?
So what we've certainly learned, so there are two interesting questions there. One is, how is sleep different across the lifespan? And the second is, how do older and young adults deal with insufficient sleep?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of sleep across the lifespan, there are just dramatic changes. Some of the most dramatic changes happen in the first 18 to 24 months of life, in fact. Your sleep structure changes. You start to stabilize. You start to have regular, longer bouts of sleep. And then you start to actually have different types of sleep. An infant, when it sleeps, will be having predominantly rapid eye movement sleep and very little deep sleep, which is very interesting. And that seems to be common across almost every single mammal that we've studied. And then non-REM sleep starts to develop later in life, and we're not really entirely sure why. Why is it that REM sleep dominates so much early in life? And there's a theory, and we've done some work in this too, that it's actually a critical igniter of brain development. That dream sleep, REM sleep, sparks all of these neural pathways and makes them flourish. It's like an internet service provider in the brain. It populates the brain with all of these fascinating high-speed broadband connections. Then there's another dramatic change that happens in our sleep, and it happens right around adolescence. What we see is that sleep timed preference changes. And what I mean by that is when you're a younger child, you know, you want to stay up late, but it's almost impossible. You can't. You fall asleep early, and then much to the chagrin of your parents, you wake up early. Once you hit that sort of adolescent transition, a dramatic biological shift happens in what's called your 24-hour biological clock rhythm. Or your circadian rhythm is the fancy term. What that means is that you now want to start to go to bed later and wake up later, and there's nothing you can do about it. No amount of parental ranting and raving is going to make you fall asleep as a teenager at 9 o'clock at night because you have to wake up at 6 o'clock the next morning to catch the bus. And that's one of the profound tragedies of society and industrialized nations right now. Our brute forcing of adolescent teen sleep against its biological natural tendency, and it's doing our youth a terrible disservice. I'd love to come back to it. Then we maintain, we sort of gain this regular sleep pattern, our innate sleep pattern in our mid to late 20s. But then sadly comes the great sleep depression, and it happens early, somewhere between your 30s and your 40s, if you were to come into my laboratory, we can start to measure the decline in your deep sleep quality. So even by the fourth or fifth decade of life, sleep starts to deteriorate. By your 70s or your 80s, it's actually very difficult for us to pick up really true deep sleep. You've actually lost most of that deep sleep. We've done now a lot of work in the past 5 years to explore exactly why and what the causes are. And that is even more profound in dementia, particularly conditions like Alzheimer's disease. And very recently, we discovered that these two things that we so commonly associate with aging, which is poor memory or poor sort of cognitive function and poor sleep, they're not simply coincidental. They are, in fact, significantly interrelated. And the disruption of deep sleep in later life is perhaps one of the most underappreciated factors that is contributing to what we call cognitive decline, and now it seems Alzheimer's disease as well. So it is very difficult in aging. There is now good evidence that older adults do not simply need less sleep. That's another myth that I would like to dismantle. A lot of people think, well, as we get older, maybe we're not as active, or maybe we're not learning as much, or maybe our brain and our body don't need sleep as much. That's just not true. All signs point to the fact that sleep need remains just as high, but sleep generating capacity is eroded and declines. So in other words, the older adult brain simply cannot produce the sleep that it nevertheless still needs. And we are now desperately trying to find new ways, new innovative ways to restore sleep in the elderly. It's one of the moonshot goals in my laboratory. Can we give back and boost and amplify deep sleep in older adults? And in doing so, can we salvage aspects of learning and memory function and even start to fight back against disorders like Alzheimer's disease? That's the very real hope now.
All right. Well, all of us older adults will be rooting for you, Matt. But I'd like to sort of shift direction a little bit. And, you know, you mentioned your sleep and neuroimaging laboratory, and you've also mentioned the explosion of science. And would you tell us a little bit about the work that you're currently doing in the lab, and what is this explosion of science that you're talking about, and how is that helping you discover some of these new things about sleep?
So the research that I do in my lab has many different programs. Some of them, that, as you mentioned, are clinical. I'm not an MD, by the way, and I don't pretend to be one or play one in the public forum, a PhD, but we do work with clinical populations, psychiatric populations, and patients with dementia, Alzheimer's. But we also do a lot of very basic science research, still trying to uncover all of these wonderful nutritional benefits that sleep provides for the brain and the body. And there's still lots more to discover. But the explosion of research understanding regarding sleep has been driven by technology. And we have all of these now new wonderful methods of brain science to actually explore sleep in ways that we never could examine before. We can actually measure patterns of brainwave activity during sleep. And we can also peer deep inside of the brain with things like MRI scanners as people are sleeping. And we can look to see which parts of the brain are switching on and switching off. And we can also sort of decompose these brainwave patterns and really understand their individual parts. It's like a prism where you're beaming white light and then you can split it apart into its component different shades and hues. We're able to do that now with remarkable technologies. And by doing that, we've really been able to speak in the currency of the brain, which is oscillations and brainwaves and patterns of brain activity and networks of brain activity. And we've been able to explore the body in finer detail than we ever could before. We can look at genetics now, genetic screening. We can do blood draws. We can do measurements of heart rate and cardiac function. And we can start to then unite all of these things together. We can get a holistic, embodied view of the human while they sleep. And then we can actually look to see how that predicts that same embodied set of measurements while they're awake, and then pattern match those two and understand so much more about sleep. So it's been this sort of revolution of new science and technology as to how we can understand the biology of living organisms and life, Homo sapiens included. And it's that that has given us this traction that we just didn't have in perhaps the 1960s or the 70s regarding sleep.
That's fascinating. That must just be amazing to be able to see all these different things going on in the body and the brain and make the correlations. I'm curious, you know, is there a particular focus of your research currently or this year, a particular direction that you're going in?
So we have, sorry to come back to that. We have several different areas of work that we're doing. For example, one of them I've already mentioned is our work in aging and Alzheimer's disease. Right now, based on work that's really coming out from my lab and some other labs around the world, insufficient sleep across the lifespan is fast becoming the most significant lifestyle factor determining whether or not you will develop Alzheimer's disease. And this is an incredibly hot topic now. And it's bidirectional. And what we now understand is that at night, during deep sleep, the brain actually cleanses itself of toxins that have been building up during the day. And it's important that people realize that wakefulness is low-level brain damage. And I don't mean to be alarmist in saying that. It's simply a scientific fact that with all of this metabolic combustion of activity that happens while we're awake inside of the brain, you build up excretory products, just like in the rest of your body. And there's a system in your brain, a sewage system. It's called the glymphatic system with a G. It's just like the lymphatic system of your body. And at night is when that glymphatic system kicks into high gear. And one of the things that that sewage system in the brain clears out during deep sleep is this sticky toxic protein that you mentioned at the start of the call called beta amyloid. And it's one of the leading factors that we believe causes Alzheimer's disease. And now we realize why then insufficient sleep can set you on a trajectory path towards Alzheimer's. Because if you're not getting that deep sleep that you need throughout your life, you're not cleansing the brain of that toxic protein. Then we made a discovery that where that toxic protein builds up, if you allow it to build up, is not just randomly all over the brain. The Alzheimer's protein, amyloid, will actually develop in some parts of the brain and not in others. And sadly, the parts of the brain that it targets early on and most aggressively are the centers that generate that very deep sleep that I was just telling you about that actually helps cleanse the brain of amyloid. So it's a vicious cycle. And we've now made in this discovery our understanding that if you don't get that deep sleep at night, more of that protein builds up, then it builds up in these deep sleep areas, so you can't generate the sleep even when you give yourself the chance to get it. So more of that protein builds up, which then decreases the amount of deep sleep that you subsequently get, and through this sort of spiral, it leads to what we know is an accelerated trajectory. So that's one of the areas that is exciting for us right now. And of course, one of the other features of that discovery, I know it sounds very depressing for people out there, and I don't mean it to be, but there's a silver lining. By making this discovery that sleep is a new missing piece in the explanatory puzzle of Alzheimer's, it's not the only one, please don't think that. There are many factors that we know contribute to Alzheimer's, but sleep seems to be one. Unlike many of the other factors, changes, for example, in the blood flow dynamics of the brain or the chemistry of the brain, sleep is a potentially treatable target. We can actually do something about sleep. It's very difficult for us to change blood flow in the brain right now. Modern medicine doesn't have good methods to do that. But we do have some new methods, and one of the ways that we're exploring this is by using electrical brain stimulation. We've been doing some of this work. Other groups in Europe have pioneered this method too. And you apply very small amounts of electricity into the brain. It's so small you don't feel it. But if you pulse that electricity in time with those deep sleep brain waves that I was describing, almost as though you're singing in time with the natural rhythm of the brain, in young healthy adults, you can almost amplify the size of those deep sleep brain waves, and you can almost double the amount of memory benefit that you get from sleep as a consequence. So the question now is, can we translate these same types of technologies into older adults and those with dementia and give back that sleep? So I think that's a great area. I should note, by the way, that for callers, it's important to realize the potential limitations of sleeping medications. It's a very touchy subject, but I do want to address it.
Sure.
Medications are not advised for the long term, and in fact, they are not advised even as the primary treatment for poor sleep. Sleeping pills do not produce naturalistic sleep. If I were to show you the electrical readout of your brain when you're taking sleeping pills versus natural sleep, they're not the same. Sleeping pills, common sleeping pills, I won't name them, but many people will know them. They keep you out of the deep stages of sleep. And those sleeping pills have commonly been called the sedative hypnotics for a good reason. Sedation is not sleep. Now, I'm not going to argue that when you take those sleeping pills that you're awake at night. You're not. You're certainly not awake. But to suggest that you're in naturalistic sleep is an equal falsehood. And there is now some really quite damning evidence regarding the use of sleeping pills and increased risk of mortality as well as increased risk of cancer. People, if they would like to read more about this topic, the dangers of sleeping pills, please Google a scientist called Daniel Kripke, and that's Kripke with a K, or you can go, I think it's just Google the dark side of sleeping pills, and he has a website that will describe to you the dangers of sleeping pills. There is hope here. There is a new method called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia for anyone who is having a sleep problem. You can just Google that. CBT-I, so cognitive behavioral therapy, and the I stands for insomnia. It is just as, if not more effective than sleeping pills in the short term. You work with a therapist. It doesn't require drugs. But better still, it's much longer lasting than sleeping pills. One of the problems with sleeping pills is that you start to use them, and if you stop, you have this what's called an insomnia rebound effect, which is where you not only go back to the bad sleep that you were having before, but your sleep is even worse now because of drug tolerance and drug expectation. So we're looking at non-pharmacological new technology ways to improve sleep in the elderly. We're not using drugs because right now I don't think the evidence is strong enough to suggest that they are beneficial. I'm not anti-drug. Please don't think that. I work with drug industries, if we can produce a drug that does offer natural sleep, and the science proves that, I will very much support it. It's just simply right now, we haven't got there yet. So,
Arya, you know, I just wanted to jump in here for a second because we did have a couple of callers that wanted to ask a question in regard to some of the Alzheimer discussion that you were having earlier. We have Mila, who actually is listening from the UK right now, and she was asking, you know, what's one thing that we can do in our older age to salvage from that lack of sleep? And how is it that some elders do have dementia or Alzheimer's and some don't? Does it mean that those who do have it have lost valuable sleep in their lifetime?
Two great questions. So firstly, in terms of sleep as we get older, there are several things that we can do. These are things that we call sleep hygiene or the principles of sleep hygiene. If you just Google sleep hygiene, you'll get a list of these things, and they are helpful across all ages, but they're helpful in the elderly. Firstly, you can try to help regulate your rhythms. As you get older, you actually start to regress back to childhood in terms of your sleep preference. You want to go to bed earlier and then wake up earlier. And that's a problem because a lot of older adults don't want to go to bed, you know, at 8 or 9. They want to be around, have an active social life, maybe, you know, stay up with the grandkids and family members. But trying to adhere to a regular sleep schedule, waking up at the same time every day and going to sleep at the same time. The other thing that older adults commonly do that they make a mistake on is that they fall asleep in the afternoon and evening, and that should be, that's ill-advised. So when sometimes I meet my older participants in these studies, I'll say, you know, do you nap during the day? And they will say, no, I rarely nap. And then I'll say, well, you know, when you're perhaps watching television at night on the couch, do you sometimes sort of nod off and fall asleep? And they'll say, oh, yeah, sometimes, you know, I just... Well, that's a nap. And here's the problem with that behavior. During the day, when we're awake, we build up something called sleep pressure. There is a chemical that builds up. The chemical is called adenosine. The longer that you're awake, the more adenosine that builds up. The more adenosine that builds up, the sleepier you feel. And after about 16 hours of continued wakefulness, you're usually so sleepy that it's time to go to sleep, and you fall asleep naturally and easily. When we sleep at night, it's like a pressure valve on that steam cooker. We release and remove all of that adenosine, we clear it out, and then we wake up the next morning feeling refreshed because we've removed that adenosine, that sleep pressure. And here's the now the problem. If you're staying awake during the day as an older adult, and you're building up all of this nice sleep pressure, you're getting ready to have a good night's sleep, and then you fall asleep on the couch, or you go to the movies and you fall asleep, now you've released that sleep pressure, or at least some of that sleep pressure. Even just a couple of minutes can relieve that sleep pressure. So no wonder then you find it difficult to fall asleep at night or stay asleep throughout the night. So be really mindful of unplanned napping, and falling asleep on the couch is napping. The next thing, or the two final things, or three final things I would say for elderly individuals. Firstly, when you go out in the morning, get lots of bright light and try not to wear shades. Now, make sure you have some protection, a hat or SPF, that's good, but don't wear shades in the morning. Get lots of light to suppress your a hormone called melatonin. Melatonin is a hormone that signals darkness to your body. And when you block it with light, which is what happens, daylight helps put the brakes on melatonin, it makes your body realize that it's no longer darkness, and it wakes you up so you feel good and alert during the morning. But then what we need to do is decrease our light exposure throughout the afternoon and the evening. So now if you go out for a walk in the afternoon, now is the time to put shades on. Try not to get too much bright light exposure in the afternoon. And then as you go into the evening, try to cut down on screen time. People with televisions in their bedrooms tend to sleep worse than those who don't. People who use iPads or iPhones in the hour before bedtime tend to have significantly worse sleep than those who don't. The final thing I would say, well, caffeine too, by the way, please, if you can try to avoid caffeine after midday, that's critical. The last thing for older adults is medications. Some medications that older adults take, like hypertensives, some of those can actually prevent sleep at night. So perhaps see your primary care physician. Ask about not just what medications you're on, but the timing of administration of those medications. Because sometimes you can take the same medications, but it's just about when you take them that can help you sleep better. So it's a long, long answer, but it's such a crucial question. So I hope people don't mind me taking the time to lavish that attention on that question. I'm so dedicated to that topic.
I think we're all very appreciative of that. And actually, it's, you know, some of what you just said also sort of ties to another question from California. Pranithi is asking, you know, why do we sleep with our partner? And is there a biological or evolutionary benefit to not sleeping alone? I have a difficult time adjusting to daylight savings time as I have an early bed, early to rise schedule. So if you have any tips on adjusting this time change every 6 months, that would be great.
Yeah, so two questions there. Firstly, how are we supposed to sleep as a species? If you look at cultures that are untouched by electricity, many of them are actually co-sleepers. They all sleep as a community, as a group, which is interesting. Whether or not that is the best thing for us now in modern society is a very different question, though. We shouldn't necessarily adhere to that sort of classic hominid pattern. And the reason is this. Firstly, the frequency of sleep disorders in industrialized nations is astronomical. About 70 million Americans right now are suffering from some form of a sleep disorder. And there are over 100 different types of sleep disorders. If you look at these cultures that are not touched by electricity, those rates of sleep disorders are usually less than 1%. What that means is that sleeping as a group, now the group tends to also sleep largely at the same time because, you know, they're driven by dusk, by the sun, and by dawn. And so everyone has a much more stable, regular, common sleep pattern. Now, that's not true in industrialized life. We firstly have higher rates of sleep disorders, and people are going to bed at different times for different social and professional reasons. As a consequence, having a partner in your bed who either is off your schedule and sleeping at a different time, and or has a sleep disorder, for example, snoring and sleep apnea, or they're tossing and turning with insomnia, that has a profound impact on your sleep too. And we now know that somewhere between 40 to 60% of couples will either not sleep in the same room or they will start sleeping in the same room but then end up sleeping in different locations, either on the couch or in the spare room or a guest room. So there is now a revolution. It's largely unspoken because of the stigma, which is called the wonderful sleep divorce, where people are actually starting to decide to just go to bed in separate rooms, and they sleep so much better. And the stigma around this, of course, is that it signals that you're not having a healthy relationship, that if you're not sleeping in the same bed, then you know perhaps you're not having a physical relationship. In fact, the opposite is true if you look at the data. And sorry to sort of bring this up. I know it's a touchy subject perhaps, but just being discreet about it, people who get more sleep are more physically engaged in their relationships than people who are not getting sufficient sleep, in part because it regulates many of our hormones and our energy that is critical for that side of a nurturing physical relationship. So that's a big topic, and I think we're going to see a continued recognition of it and acceptance of it in the community. Coming on to daylight savings time, it is a problem. It's very hard to do. The body, when it shifts between time zones, cannot make up those time zones as quickly as we can now travel with this thing called the jet airplane. And it causes a mismatch between your biological clock and the new clock time in the new time zone. That mismatch produces what we call jet lag. And for every day that you are in a new time zone, your biological clock, your circadian rhythm, can adjust by about 1 hour of time. So in other words, if I fly back to the UK, which is 8 hours ahead of us, it's going to take me 8 days to catch up, an hour each day. Now, for daylight savings time, what that means is that it's going to take us a little bit of time to sort of catch up. I'm sorry, I can hear. Sorry, I probably need to finish. But I will just simply say this. The best way to try and deal with daylight savings time is to use an alarm to gradually titrate, sort of almost like coming off a drug that, you know, you're at full dose and then you come down to 80% dose and 60% dose. If you're moving towards springtime where we're going to lose an hour of sleep and we have to wake up an hour early, in the week before, try to start waking up 10 minutes earlier, you know, let's say 6 or 7 days before, and then 10 minutes earlier again the next day, then 10 minutes earlier again the next day, then 10 minutes, and just gradually move yourself sliding on that sliding scale to an earlier and earlier awakening time, rather than trying to do it all in one sitting on that one night with the time change. You will find it easier to do it in that gradual build-up fashion.
That's great. Yeah, I have a good friend of mine who lives in the UK, and when she comes to visit her family in California and stays for a couple of weeks, literally about a week or so before, she has two young girls, and she starts to move them to the California time sleep schedule, so that way it isn't as hectic of a transition when they do get over there.
That's right. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just simply understanding how sleep works. I think there's so much bad information out there, and so I'm actually going to be publishing a book next year, my first sort of late science popular book, I hope. On sleep, and it's really aimed at, from doing a lot of sort of public speaking and radio and television, there's so much, I think, lack of understanding. Scientists like myself have done such a poor job of getting the science and the good word of sleep out there in a digestible, meaningful way, and society's sleep neglect and society's apathy towards sleep, in part, is because people like myself have failed to communicate with the public, and that was one of the reasons to motivate me to try and put pen to paper and write this book and get the good word of sleep out there. So I hope this call helps along those lines too.
So, Matt, I had another question, sort of shifting frames again. You talk about the global sleep loss epidemic as the greatest public health challenge we're now facing. And hearing what you're saying, that makes a lot of sense. Before the call, I was curious and Googled public health challenges, and I got all kinds of lists. Here's one from the CDC that was published, I think, in March of this year. And what they have on the list are alcohol-related harms, food safety, healthcare-associated infections, heart disease and strokes, HIV, motor vehicle injury, nutrition, physical activity and obesity, prescription drug overdose, teen pregnancy and tobacco use. They don't have sleep on their list, and I didn't see it on other lists. So how, you know, what do you say about that discrepancy?
Well, what's fascinating to begin with is that almost every one of those largest public health concerns is directly related to insufficient sleep. So, for example, we know that insufficient sleep is tied to higher rates of cardiovascular disease, to calcification of your coronary arteries, to hypertension and stroke. We also know that sleep loss is causally associated with obesity. It is also causally related to diabetes. Sleep loss has a profound impact on your immune health. And in fact, you can go through so many of the classic immune disorders, even the common cold. People who get 6 hours of sleep or less are somewhere between 50 to 60% more likely to catch a cold than those people sleeping 8 hours or more. Cancer, is now strongly linked to insufficient sleep. That list includes cancer of the bowel, cancer of the prostate, and cancer of the breast right now. So much so that, in fact, the World Health Organization recently classified any form of nighttime shift work as a probable carcinogen. That jobs that disrupt your sleep-wake rhythm are cancer-inducing. That's how strong the evidence is right now. Motor vehicle accidents. Let me speak about that. We now know that drowsy driving causes more accidents on our roads than either drugs or alcohol combined. And yet we spend a fraction of 1% of our public health policy budget on educating people about the dangers of insufficient sleep. So risky behavior too, drug addiction and drug taking, teenage pregnancies, risk and reward behaviors are intimately tied to insufficient sleep. We've done a lot of work in this area too, particularly in adolescent youth. You shorten their sleep, they become much more risk-taking and sensation-seeking. They engage in behaviors that are higher likelihood risk behaviors. So every one of the conditions on that list has a link to insufficient sleep. So why it is not on that list is so desperately sad and striking to me, and that's why people like myself, I think, need to come out and be much better sleep ambassadors. We need to go to places like Capitol Hill. We need to go to Washington. We need to not just go there waving our hands saying, look, this is the problem. We need to come up with 21st century new visions of solutions. And that's one of the things that I speak about in the forthcoming book, and it's one of the things that I'm trying to now push very hard with a number of public advocacy policies. We need to change society for the better. We need to reorient and prioritize sleep. So,
very interesting. Yes, so what you're saying is that this is a public health challenge, which is behind many of the other public health challenges, and that this sort of meta public health challenge needs to get on the radar screen.
If we bend the downward arrow of insufficient sleep in society, and it really is only going in that one direction, if we bend that arrow back up against itself, start sleeping more, all of those health dangers and concerns that are on that list will change as a consequence. We know this from intervention studies in each one of those domains. If you treat sleep disorders, or you regularize sleep, or you causally improve sleep in individuals, those health metrics also improve. You can, in people who have sleep disorders, for example, which lead to cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's, if you start treating those sleep disorders, like sleep disordered breathing or sleep apnea, you can actually delay the onset of cognitive decline by somewhere between 5 to 10 years. So there's a causal intervention that staves off ill health and dementia. So if we rectify sleep, we rectify the brain and the body. It's almost like the Swiss Army knife of health. You know, I've heard a lot of people say that sleep is the third pillar of good health, along with diet and exercise. And I actually disagree. I think actually sleep is the very foundation on which those two other pillars of health sit. And we know this too, that if you erode sleep, dieting becomes ineffective. Physical exercise also is diminished and eroded. It's where everything starts. There's a good night of sleep. It provides nothing more than the greatest recharge to your waking life, more than anything else that we know right now.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to just ask one more question, and we have lots of questions here in the queue. Something that you and I had discussed earlier and that I've been very curious about, and that is how is sleep, the way any of us might be getting a night's sleep, affected by where we live, by our cultural background, by our socioeconomic status?
Such a wonderful question. This is another area that is now coming to light. I've spoken a lot about how and why we sleep from a biological level, from sort of the physiology of our brain and our body. And of course, they are the strong determinants. Our biology is a big determinant of how we sleep. But sleep is also determined socially. It's a social construct. You know, just think about it right now. Who are you? What is your social standing? And do you think that makes a difference to how you sleep relative to, for example, let's say someone who is of low socioeconomic status? What is their sleeping condition like? And do you think their social status changes their opportunity to get good sleep? And the answer is, of course, yes. And the answer comes in a variety of different forms. There are different factors that pressure poor sleep in low socioeconomic classes. There's a deep sleep disparity right now that is not just biological in cause, but is social in cause. And firstly, one of the critical reasons is your sleeping situation. So if you live in a neighborhood where there is high crime, for example, then that psychological anchor of threat, of danger, will prevent you from getting a full and normal night of sleep. And this we know, there's lots of good studies demonstrating that that psychological sort of weight of danger. You know, if you're in a neighborhood where there is constant violence or there is constant potential of burglary or home intrusion, imagine how well you would sleep at night. Not particularly well, I'm sure. The other thing is how work pressures sleep and grabs sleep like a vice grip and squeezes it from top and tail. What I mean by that is a lot of low pay, low socioeconomic employment is in the service industry right now. And the service industry jobs tend to start very early in the morning. And as a consequence, people in low SES families, low socioeconomic families, also often don't have a car. So they are often taking public transport. So to get to those early jobs, which can sometimes start at 5 or 6 in the morning, they may have to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get to those jobs. And then when they come home, sometimes they may have two jobs, one that goes through from the afternoon into the evening. Also, these are often families that have just one parent. So you have this huge burden of childcare in the evenings, and then you're waking up at 4 o'clock the next morning to get to your job again. So there is an economic and an employment disparity that forces poor sleep in these communities too.
Now, thank you, Matt. There's a ton of questions here from our listeners.
Yes, I had a question. I thank you for pointing out the problems with the sleeping pills. I've got some pills that I'm taking for antidepressant and they and other medications, and they're messing with my sleep, and I have to take Ambien to go to sleep. And if I don't take it, I do have that rebound kind of insomnia. What kind of suggestions do you have?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, obviously it's important to be guided by your physician. And as I mentioned, I'm not an MD, so I'm not here to give medical advice. But the wisdom out there right now is it's good to go and see a board-certified sleep medical doctor if you're having sleep problems. Sometimes even our regular GPs are not perhaps up to date on the latest in sleep medicine. It's striking when you look at the medical syllabus, by the way, and I'm involved in this too, how much education our doctors get regarding sleep and its important functions. It's actually not enough. It's not anywhere sufficient. So I would think about if you're having problems with sleep and the sleeping pills aren't serving you well, I would perhaps seek out or ask for a referral to a board-certified sleep medicine doctor. If you are in the California area, there are some great sleep clinics around here. UCSF has a great clinic. Stanford has a great sleep clinic. If you are not, please just go to the National Sleep Foundation. Just Google National Sleep Foundation, and on their website you can actually find a link to locations where there are great sleep centers that they advocate, and you can find a particular doctor who will help talk you through the alternatives. But right now, one of the strongest alternatives and the first line treatment defense for insomnia has now shifted to cognitive behavioral therapy and away from short-term sleeping pill use.
Okay, thank you. It's long-term sleeping pill use, so
yeah,
thank you.
And that's usually not right now, according to the American Board of Sleep Medicine, the long-term prescription use of sleeping pills is not advocated, as I currently understand the recommendation. So maybe that's something that you you would want to take up with your GP and also perhaps with a board-certified sleep doctor.
Okay, thank you so very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I hope you find the solution to sleep.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to your whole presentation. I've been taking a lot of notes. And thank you. Thank you. You as I'm writing, you're saying certain things that are crucial. So my question is, what are the ingredients necessary for a good, not necessarily night of sleep, but just a good, rewarding session of sleep?
Yeah, and let me just come back to a couple of points, because I think you make such a great affirmation there that diseases can cause sleep problems. We know this, that there are a number of conditions, many conditions, in fact, that do lead to sleep disruption. But I do also want to be clear that it's bidirectional, that we know that if you take an individual, or there's actually, unfortunately, lots of evidence now, even in animal studies, that if you causally manipulate sleep, you can trigger disease. So it works both ways. The path, it's a two-way street in terms of disease and sleep disorders. In terms of good sleep, I would say that the sleep hygiene principles are the best principles that you can use to obtain a sound night of sleep. Your point also is a really essential one. It's not just about sleep quantity. It's also about sleep quality. It's not one or the other. It's both. You can't simply just have great sleep quality for 4 hours and then sort of shortchange the rest of sleep and get away with it. But nor can you actually sleep for 10 hours but have very poor and fragmented sleep and get away with it too. So the science we now have is really quite definitive. It's both quantity and quality. So with that being said, there are really several critical sleep hygiene factors. Firstly, try to stay away from caffeine after midday, as I mentioned. The second is wake up at the same time of day if you can. If there is a single most prescribed piece of advice from sleep doctors, it is that wake up at the same time of day each and every day and do not float at the weekends. Don't sleep in one pattern during the week and then sleep in a different manner during the weekend. That's critical too. The next thing is try to stay away from alcohol in the evenings. Many people think alcohol sort of helps them fall asleep. That's a misnomer. Alcohol, just like sleeping pills, is a sedative. And alcohol will sedate you, but it won't give you sleep. It will fragment your sleep. You will wake up many times throughout the night, and plus it blocks your dream sleep. So that's the next thing. Stay away from alcohol. The third thing is avoid napping during the day. We've spoken about that. The next thing is light, and I mentioned that a little bit too. Lots of bright light in the morning. Try to cycle down your light in the evening, particularly those blue light devices, LED devices. The next thing is to find a sort of a relaxation routine before bed. Many people in this day and age, the only time we get to reflect on what's going on inside of our head is when it hits the pillow, and that's the last thing that we should be doing. So try to spend a little bit of time winding down, take a bath. Baths help. They actually drop your core body temperature. It sounds strange, I know, but you get in the bath, you warm up, you come out the bath, then you drop your core body temperature dramatically. That drop in core body temperature allows you to fall asleep quicker. You need to drop your body temperature to initiate sleep. It's the reason that it's always easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot. So decrease the AC, decrease the thermostat setting. Most people don't realize that a comfortable temperature for good sleep is usually somewhere between 65 to 70 degrees. Most people have the thermostat set to higher temperature. So try to throttle down temperature. Having a warm bath helps with that. So those are some things that I hope helps people or helps will help people get that good quality of sleep as well as good quantity of sleep.
That's great. And thank you for that question. And, you know, we have a lot of interest from people from around the world. Isabel writes to us from Munich, Germany, and she says, thank you. I've been really looking forward to this call. I'm one of those that's sleeping less and less. And is that reversible? And I've done this for years. And is there any benefit to changing now that I'm, in my 60s?
There is always benefit, and I think one should always hold out hope to try and obtain the very best sleep that your brain at that time of life is capable of. And as I said, I think some of these sleep hygiene tips, if you just go out there and Google the term sleep hygiene, should really help give your biology at this stage of life the best chance of producing the very best quantity and quality of sleep that it can. So I think there's usually always room for improvement in individuals. Even in later life, there is always room for improvement. And then I think it's, speaking with your physician or a board-certified sleep specialist to look into perhaps things like chronic pain that you're suffering, other conditions that can contribute to insufficient sleep, things like anxiety, depression. If you manage those or if you manage your pain in a better way, you can actually get better sleep. Thinking about trying to throttle down medications that increase urination at night, that's one of the problems as we get older. We tend to go to the bathroom more, and then it's harder to fall asleep once we get back. I should also note the other thing not to be too concerned about. If you wake up at night and you're having a problem getting back to sleep, firstly, try not to fret. Secondly, don't stay in bed. If you haven't fallen asleep when you get back into bed after about 15 or 20 minutes, don't stay in bed. Instead, get out of bed, go to a different room. In dim light, just do something that's relaxing, like reading a book that's not going to sort of, cause the wheels in the mind to start spinning. Don't get on an iPad or check an email. Stay off technology. And only when you feel tired and sleepy, then come back to bed. And the reason is this, that your brain is an incredibly associative device. And if you stay in bed and you're awake, your brain starts to link and associate and make a connection between being in bed and staying awake rather than being in bed and falling asleep. And you need to break that association. So just accept that tonight is probably not going to be a great night. Tomorrow you're going to feel a little tired because you've woken up and you're not getting back to sleep quickly. But try not to fret. Get out of bed. Do something relaxing. When you feel sleepy, come back to bed. Fall asleep. Break that association. Don't sleep too long the next morning, because then you'll get into a cycle where you're waking up later and later, and now you can't fall asleep that night at a normal bedtime because you haven't been awake long enough to build up all of that healthy sleep pressure. So these are things that can really sort of help. So try to follow those sleep hygiene tips. It should help you out even in later life.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for this wonderful information. My name is Kozo. I'm calling in from Cupertino, California. And I was really struck by when you said that, what you reiterated just a minute ago, that sleep and bad sleep patterns can actually cause disease. And I'm wondering if you know if there's any research being done on sleep being actually a therapeutic for disease. So let's say you were diagnosed with cancer. Are there any research being done where, you know, they require people to sleep in a certain way for a certain amount of time and then check and see if that affects the disease? And a related question is there any movement or any research being done on sleep in hospitals? Because it seems to me, like you said, sedation is not natural sleep. And in a hospital environment, it seems like sleep's almost impossible, right? They come in and check on you. You have a roommate. They're moving things around. They got lights on. And
that's right.
I'm just wondering if that is, you know, causing more disease or causing more mortality.
So the answer to both of those questions is an emerging yes, but not a concrete. The evidence is concrete, but the movement isn't really in full swing right now. What I mean by that is we have good evidence in clinical studies and in animal models that suggests that if you bidirectionally perturb sleep, you can accelerate or retard certain diseases. And a good example of this is cancer. If you are fighting a battle against cancer and not getting sufficient sleep, we now know that that cancer will grow more aggressively and more quickly. So people are now trying to think about prioritizing sleep as an agent that will aid in the fight against cancer. And there's some really powerful and quite disturbing animal studies out there showing that if you are shortchanging animals who have cancer and you're shortchanging them of sleep, that cancer can increase in its speed and size of growth by up to 200%. So the evidence is there that sleep is causal and is bidirectional in the difference that it can make, and it has forced people like me to start trying to advocate to medicine and doctors that we need to start prescribing sleep. Not prescribing sleep medications, but prescribing sleep as the elixir of life, as a panacea for good health, and perhaps one of the best Archimedes lever that we could think of for actually brute forcing health under the attack of disease. And we will see more of that in the future. In terms of sleep in hospitals, you're absolutely right. There is now a slow but growing recognition that it is a major problem. The place where I would argue you need a good night of sleep the most is perhaps the last place that you get it, which is a hospital. And one of the things that I write about in the forthcoming book is why don't we, for nominal cost, do what we do on transatlantic flights. We give people a free eye mask and a free pair of earplugs. It's a small, small cost, and it would help significantly with improving sleep. Now, we've even seen evidence in neonates in the intensive care unit. If you regularize their sleep, they exit out of the neonatal intensive care unit within half of the time. It's dramatic, the improvement in health, if you regularize sleep in the hospital setting. So short answer, yes to both of those, but more needs to happen in both of those. I hope that helps. Great questions.
Well, thank you for being the vanguard in both those realms. You're doing a wonderful service. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my privilege and I think further an honor to do that.
Thanks again for your question there, Kozo. You know, going back to some of our callers that are writing in online, you know, Albert from Oakland is saying, you know, thank you so much. He's like, so what I'm hearing is that a nap during the day is not really encouraged, which is somewhat contrary to a lot of older stories of certain cultures that may have benefited from the tradition of a siesta, or when you take a look at children, for example, napping is actually encouraged for them just for their own brain development. And so is there maybe a shift that happens, you know, at a certain age where that's no longer required or needed?
That's right. Yeah. So let me be very, very clear about naps and their use. Firstly, children should be napping. Children very early in life are what we call polyphasic in their sleep. That simply means lots of phases of sleep. Then they become biphasic in their sleep. They have an afternoon nap and then a longer bout at night. if you do look at cultures that aren't touched by electricity, many of them are biphasic. They will sleep sort of 6.5-7 hours of sleep at night, and then they will have a siesta-like behavior in the afternoon. So we may be, in modern-day societies, not sleeping the way that we are naturally programmed, and I think there's good evidence for that, which would lead to the suggestion that we should be napping. But here's the problem. Most people are not able to regularly nap. And it's in that context where sleep medicine right now advocates against napping. So if you can regularly nap during the day, day after day, in a very stable manner, and you can do so early in the afternoon, then napping is advocated only under the further condition that you are not having problems in falling asleep at night. But if you can only nap irregularly, then it is not advised. Secondly, it is not advised that you nap late in the day. And finally, for older adults, if you are napping and having problems with sleep at night, it is strongly advocated against that you don't nap during the day and that you try to just push all of that sleep pressure into firstly getting a good night of sleep throughout the night. So children, great to be napping, natural. Human beings, innately, we may be biphasic, we may be born natural nappers throughout our adult lives. It's just that in modern day society, very few people can nap regularly, and if you can't, then it seems to be problematic, especially later in the day.
Do natural supplements support sleep, like calcium, magnesium tablets, and herbs to promote natural sleep, or something like melatonin, which I know that you had said earlier?
Yeah, so sadly the evidence isn't particularly strong in clinical trials. If you are in a significant nutrient deficient state, that can have an impact on your sleep, and I want to be clear about that. But many of the homeopathic medications and even melatonin, as long as, and this is melatonin in the context of once you're in a new time zone and you're stable, you're not suffering from jet lag, homeopathic medicines, for the most part, and melatonin have not held up under clinical trials to be any more efficacious than placebo. Now, so let me be clear about that. If you're taking melatonin or some type of homeopathic medication and you feel as though it helps your sleep, my recommendation is keep taking it. And the reason is this, that the placebo effect is the most reliable effect in all of pharmacology. And what that tells us is that there is such a thing as mind over matter, and science is now grappling with this. It's acknowledged the placebo effect, and it's realized that we should take advantage of it. So I don't mean to be dismissive of people who are finding those things to be helpful. All I would say is that the help that they provide does not seem to be anything above and beyond placebo, based on the science that we have right now.
Hello, my name is Suzanne. I'll try to be fast. Our new president concerns me in that he stays awake tweeting all night, and a lot more. Is he going to be able to judge adequately not sleeping? He boasts about that.
Great question, and it strikes at the very heart of one of the biggest problems with sleep, and the answer is no, he's not going to be able to judge based on the scientific evidence. And the fact is this, your subjective sense of how well you're doing when you haven't been sleeping enough is a miserable predictor of objectively how poorly you're doing with insufficient sleep. What I mean by that is you don't really know that you're sleep deprived when you're sleep deprived. The analogy is a drunk driver at a bar who's had five or six shots of vodka and a couple of beers, and then they pick up their keys at the end of the night, and they say, I'm fine to drive home. And your response is, no, I know that you think you're fine to drive, but trust me, you're not. Objectively, you are certainly not okay to drive. It's the same with sleep deprivation, and we've got great data demonstrating this. So that's the reason that people will say to you, no, I'm actually one of those people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep or less.
Yes.
That's sadly just not true. Based on the scientific data of over 17,000 studies, the number of people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep or less without measurable impairment, rounded to a whole number, and expressed as a percent is zero.
Oh, well, goodness. All right. Well, thank you so much for that.
You're very welcome.
Bless us all. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Matt, for sharing so much information. I'm just blown away. I think we need another hour of you, but I'll make it quick. This is Mission New York, and I'm now questioning the benefit of my sleep pattern after listening. And I would love to get your opinion. I'm a senior. I fall asleep as soon as my head hits the pillow. I sleep straight through for about 4 hours. Then I'll wake up between 1 and 3 times for a few minutes, go back to sleep right away each time, have more dreams, wake up as soon as my feet hit the floor, I'm alert. Is there any quality to this sleep pattern?
So is your question that you're worried about the waking up throughout the night? Is that your concern? As long as there are two conditions satisfied, firstly, as long as you're finding the ability to fall asleep quickly after those awakenings without a problem, and secondly, during the day, if you're feeling restored by your sleep and you're not sort of feeling as though you're nodding off or you're lacking in energy, then the chances are that the sleep that you're getting is sufficient. But if it's not, or you're concerned that you don't think your sleep is sufficient, definitely do go and see your doctor and just sort of let them know about those sleep problems. But from the sounds of it, it doesn't seem as though you're having, and again, I'm not a board-certified sleep medicine doctor, so I can't give a medical opinion, but from what you're telling me, it doesn't necessarily sound as though you're suffering from one of the two forms of insomnia. One of them is called sleep onset insomnia, which is having problems falling asleep. The second is sleep maintenance insomnia, which is difficulty in staying asleep such that you wake up throughout the night and then you find it difficult to fall back asleep. It sounds as though you do wake up, but you are able to get back to sleep. Is that about right?
Usually right away, yeah. And yeah, I do go back into dreams.
Yeah, and as I said early in the call, the second half of the night is much more dream-rich sleep,
right,
whereas the first half of the night is much more sort of deep, dreamless sleep. So that makes a lot of sense, so that shouldn't be concerning.
Thank you so much. I feel much better. I feel better now.
You're
great
welcome.
Call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mish. Appreciate it. I'm going to go to, we have one of our online questions is that, do you have any recommendations for any kind of smartphone apps for monitoring the quality of our sleep? Have you heard of things like Motion X? Are there techniques for getting more both dream sleep and non-dream sleep?
I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag out there right now in terms of these sort of sleep assessment tools. And I should note that I also work with a startup company, full disclaimer, over in San Francisco. I'm a scientific advisor. But I think right now the apps that try to track your sleep are perhaps not particularly accurate. I think we'll get there very soon. In the next 2 to 3 years, we'll have good sleep tracking devices. And I'm excited about that because right now technology is one of the biggest enemies in the bedroom for sleep. But I think it's going to be technology that is our sort of salvation. And the reason is this, there's a common adage in sort of an old adage in medicine, which is what gets measured gets managed. And for so many of us, for so many decades, we've never really had a handle on how we're sleeping because we couldn't measure it apart from our subjective sense of what time we turn the lights out and what time we woke up. And that's not a very accurate rendering of our sleep, it turns out. So I'm very hopeful that very soon we'll have wearable technology or technology in the bedroom that accurately tracks our sleep. And once we take control of our sleep, we'll be able to better manage our sleep. And I think that that's fast going to happen, and it will only be good for society.
For our final question, when you think about advocacy for institutional change in this realm, this is again from Panidi, how do we encourage our schools and our work schedules to prioritize sleep? And when you think about just the difficult personal circumstances of certain people, whether they're a single parent or, like you said, the professional obligations that might come into hand or familial obligations, If someone was just limited by the mere fact that there are only 24 hours in a day, are there ways to sort of maximize the efficacy of that short amount of time of sleep, or is it just we're out of luck?
Sadly, we're out of luck. There is just no way to cheat the brain and the body out of sleep. One way or another, it will catch up to you, whether or not it's chronic sleep deprivation across a lifespan leading to chronic disease and ill health, or it's the tragedy of mortality. And this brings us back to road traffic accidents. When you are not sleeping enough, you have what's called micro sleeps at the wheel, where sometimes your eyelids will partially close. Now, at 65 miles an hour, and if you have a microsleep that lasts usually just for 1 or 2 seconds, at 65 miles an hour, that means you will drift from one lane to the next. So at that moment, for those 2 seconds, there is now a one-ton missile traveling at 65 miles an hour, and no one is in control. And that can obviously lead to fatal consequences, not just for you, but for those around you on the road. So one way or another, not getting sufficient sleep will come back to you, unfortunately. There's just sadly no way to shortchange it. It's non-negotiable. It's a life support system. It's a biological necessity, and it's Mother Nature's best effort yet at contra-death.
Hi, my name is Alisa. I'm in Seattle, and I'll be really quick. I work swing shift, so I do have an odd schedule, but I try to keep my sleep regular, and this is for all the people who can't do what you described and go to bed at an earlier time. Is that still okay as far as trying to keep your sleep regular but working an odd different time?
So, yeah, right now, I mean, shift work is, it is a real problem, and working at different times of day that then takes that normal window of sleep and forces it to slide across the 24-hour clock face, that really isn't an optimal way to be falling asleep. If you can... Right now, the advocacy in shift work is if you're on a shift, try to maintain that shift for long durations of time, then come off and have a long period of recovery, and then go back on that stable shift. The biggest problem with shift work is having shift work that is inconsistent. So trying to find consistency within shift work is perhaps right now, if it really has to happen. And for many people, but for some people it does. You know, we are, I'm sure, as is your job, we are serviced by people who undergo shift work, doctors, pilots, emergency service personnel, you know, nurses. Many people service us as a society by way of shift. Now, technology, I think, is going to help try to limit the burden of that some, but people still make that sacrifice for us, and we need to make it better for them, and this is one of the ways that seems to be best. If you do have to do shift work, maintain that stable shift, that off normal natural rhythm shift for a long period of time, and then once that shift ends, give yourself a long period of recovery before you have to go back into that same shift again. Right now, that's the best advocacy that medicine has.
So basically what you're saying is get a good night's sleep at a different time. And not, I'm not shortening my sleep hour. I get enough sleep. It's just that I sleep at a different time.
Yeah, even trying to sleep during the day, though, unfortunately, if you give yourself 8 hours of sleep during the day versus 8 hours of sleep at night, the sleep that you get during the day is not the same as you would get at night. It's more fragmented. It's not as deep quality of sleep, and it doesn't necessarily contain the same stages of sleep. And the reason is because biologically, you're not designed to sleep. We humans, we're not designed to sleep during the day. Us, other species are, however, but we are not. We're not nocturnal species. We're diurnal species. And so, unfortunately, so the recommendation is make sure that you do give yourself, you know, try to get that 8 hours. That's critical. But do realize that it's probably not going to be as good a quality at an 8 hours of sleep during the day as it would be 8 hours at night.
I see. So if it's like you, I go to bed at 2, wake up at, I don't know, 10 or whatever, or 1 and wake up at 10, that's not really the best thing still. You should be in an earlier pattern if you could, which I can.
If you could, but also just a little bit of a caveat on that. everyone has their own what's called circadian preference. It's also the fancy term is chronotype, which means some people are owls, some people are larks. Some people like to go to bed late and wake up late. Others like to go to bed early and wake up early. And it's natural variation, and it's determined by your genetics. It also changes across the lifespan, of course, as we've spoken about. Now, if you're one of those people who likes to go to bed late and wake up late, then the schedule that you just described, going to bed at 2 a.m. and waking up at 10 a.m., may actually be just fine. It fits perfectly with your biological rhythm. But if you are someone who is a lark, that you would like to go to bed, let's say, at sort of 10 o'clock in the evening and wake up at 6, then going to bed at 2 a.m. and waking up at 10 is not going to be optimal for your biology.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense, and I think that will make sense for a lot of people. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Work. I hope you sleep well. Thank you.
Thank you.
See, this is a very hot topic, Matt, and we really appreciate you coming to share with us today. You know, as a community, how can we support your work?
I think I would just ask people to actually propagate the good word of sleep. And rather than necessarily support my own work, I think try to learn more about sleep and try to advocate it more. Also, I think the critical thing for us to do as a society is get rid of the stigma of sufficient sleep. And this is one of the major problems right now I think we face as an industrialized world, is that we have associated getting sufficient sleep with this thing called laziness, that we think people who get 8 hours are slothful, and that they're not productive. The opposite is true. So as a society, we need to be proud of our sleep. I think we need to reclaim our right to a full night of sleep without embarrassment and without that terrible stigma of laziness. And in doing so, we may all feel what it's like to be truly awake during the day. So please don't chastise others for getting sufficient sleep, and as parents, we shouldn't chastise our children, because that parent-to-child transmission of sleep neglect is powerful and it is problematic. That's the only support I would ask for.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.